ship for decades. The crocodile elder statesman of the White Flag and Alston groups, and the St. Columbkill Sunday Night group, and Ewell's chosen home group. Wednesday night's Better Late Than Never group, for non-smoking, at St. Elizabeth's Hospital just 2 blocks down from the house. There is something queerly poignant about a deeply faded tattoo. A poignancy something along the lines of coming upon the tiny and poignantly unfashionable clothes of a child long since grown up in an attic trunk somewhere. The clothes, not the grown child, Ewell confirmed for G. Day. See, for example, White Flag's cantankerous old Francis, ferocious Francis, Gahaney's right forearm's tat, of a martini glass with a naked lady sitting in the glass with her legs kicking up over the broad flaring rim, with an old-style Rita Hayworth-era bangs intensive hairstyle. Faded to a kind of underwater blue, its incidental black lines gone soot green, and the red of the lips, nails, Subic Bay 62 USN 4-07, not lightened to pink, but more like decayed, to the dusty red of fire, through much smoke. All these old sober Boston blue-collar men's irrevocable tattoos, fading almost observably under the low-budget fluorescence of church basements and hospital auditoria. Ewell watched and charted and cross-referenced them, moved. Any number of good old USN anchors, and in Irish Boston, sooty green shamrocks, and several little frozen tableaus of little khaki figures in GI helmets plunging bayonets into the stomachs of hideous, urine-yellow, buck-toothed oriental caricatures, and screaming eagles with their claws faded blunt, and Semper Fi, all autolized to the point where the tattoos look like they're just under the surface of a murky-type pond. A tall, silent, hard-looking, old, black-haired, better-late-than-never group veteran has the terse and hateful single word, pussy, in what's faded to pond scum green, down one liver-spotted forearm. But yet, the fellow transcends even stoic regret by dressing and carrying himself as if the word simply wasn't there, or was so irrevocably there, there was no point even thinking about it. There's a deep and tremendously compelling dignity about the old man's demeanor with regards to the pussy on his arm, and Ewell actually considers approaching this fellow, Ray, the issue of sponsorship, if and when he feels it's appropriate to get an AA sponsor, if he decides it's germane in his case. Near the conclusion of this 2-month obsession, Tiny Ewell approaches Don Gately on the subject of whether the jailhouse tattoo should maybe comprise a whole separate phylum of tattoo. Ewell's personal feeling is that jailhouse tattoos aren't poignant so much as grotesque, that they seem like they weren't a matter of impulsive decoration or self-presentation, so much as simple self-mutilation arising out of boredom and general disregard for one's own body and the aesthetics of decoration. Don Gately's developed the habit of staring coolly at Ewell until the little attorney shuts up, though this is partly to disguise the fact that Gately usually can't follow what Ewell's saying, and is unsure whether this is because he's not smart or educated enough to understand Ewell, or because Ewell is simply out of his fucking mind. Don Gately tells Ewell how your basic type jailhouse tat is homemade with sewing needles from the jailhouse canteen and some blue ink from the cartridge of a fountain pen, promoted from the breast pocket of an unalert public defender, is why the jailhouse genre is always the same night sky blue. The needle is dipped in the ink and jabbed as deep into the tattooee as it can be jabbed without making him recoil and fucking up your aim. Just a plain, ultra-minimal blue square like Gately's got on his right wrist takes half a day and hundreds of individual jabs. How come the lines are never quite straight and the colors never quite all the way solid is it's impossible to get all the individualized punctures down to the same uniform deepness in the, like, twitching flesh. This is why jailhouse tats always look like they were done by sadistic children on rainy afternoons. Gately has a blue square on his right wrist and a sloppy cross on the inside of his mammoth left forearm. He's done the square himself, and a cellmate had done the cross in return for Gately doing a cross on the cellmate. Oral narcotics rendered the process both less painful and less tedious. The sewing needle is sterilized in grain alcohol, which Gately explains that the alcohol is got by taking messhall fruit and mashing it up and adding water and secreting the whole mess in a Ziploc just inside the flush hole thing of the cell's toilet to, like, foment. The sterilizing results of this can be consumed as well. Bonded liquor and cocaine are the only things hard to get inside of MDC penal institutions, because the expense of them gets everybody all excited, and it's only a matter of time before somebody goes and eats cheese. The inexpensive C-IV oral narcotic Toluene can be traded for cigarettes, however, which can, in turn, be got at the canteen or won at cribbage and dominoes. MDC regulations prohibit straight-out cards, or got in mass quantities off smaller inmates in return for protection from the romantic advances of larger inmates. Gately is right-handed, and his arms are roughly the size of tiny Ewell's legs. His wrist's jailhouse square is canted and has sloppy extra blobs at three of the corners. Your average jailhouse tack can't be removed even with laser surgery because it's incised so deep in. Gately is polite about Tiny Ewell's inquiries, but not expansive. That is, Tiny has to ask very specific questions about whatever he wishes to know, and then gets a short, specific answer from Gately to just that question. Then Gately stares at him, a habit Ewell tends to complain about at some length up in the five-man room. His interest in tattoos seems to be regarded by Gately not as invasive, but as the temporary obsession of a still-quivering, substanceless psyche that in a couple weeks will have forgot all about tattoos, an attitude Ewell finds condescending in the extremis. Gately's attitude toward his own primitive tattoos is a second-category attitude, with most of the stoicism and acceptance of his tat regret sincere, if only because these irrevocable emblems of jail are minor rung bells compared to some of the fucked up and really irrevocable impulsive mistakes Gately'd made as an active drug addict and burglar, not to mention their consequences, the mistakes, which Gately's trying to accept he'll be paying off for a real long time. Michael Pemulis has this habit of looking first to one side and then over to the other before he says anything. It's impossible to tell whether this is unaffected or whether Pemulis is emulating some film noir-type character. It's worse when he's put away a couple dreams. He and Trevor Axford and Hal and Condenza are in Pemulis's room, with Pemulis's roommates, Schacht and Trolch, down at lunch, so they're alone. Pemulis and Axford and Hal, stroking their chins, looking down at Michael Pemulis's yachting cap on his bed. Lying inside the overturned hat are a bunch of fair-sized but bland-looking tablets of the allegedly incredibly potent DMZ. Pemulis looks all around behind them in the empty room. This, Inkster, axe handle, is the incredibly potent DMZ, the great white shark of organosynthesized hallucinogens, the gargantuan feral infant of, Hal says, we get the picture, the Yale University of the Ivy League of Acid, says Axford, your ultimate psychosensual distorter, Pemulis sums up. I think you mean psychosensory, unless I don't know the whole story here. Axford gives Hal a narrow look, interrupting Pemulis means having to watch him do the head thing all over again each time. Hard to find, gentlemen. As in very hard to find. Last lots came off the line in the early 70s. These tablets here are artifacts. Certain amount of decay and potency, probably inevitable. Used in certain shady CIA-era military experiments. Axford nods down at the hat, Mind control? More like getting the enemy to think their guns are hydrangea. The enemy's a blood relative, that sort of thing. Who knows? The accounts I've been reading have been incoherent, gistless. Experiments conducted, things got out of hand. Let's just say things got out of control. Potency judged too incredible to proceed. Subjects locked away in institutions and written off as casualties of peace. Formula shredded. Research teams scattered, reassigned. Vague, but I've got to tell you, pretty sobering rumors. These are from the early 70s, Axe Handel says.
See the little trademark on each one? With a guy in bell bottoms and long sideburns?
Is that what that is? Unprecedentedly potent, this stuff. The Swiss inventor, they say, was originally recommending LSD-25 as what to take to come down off the stuff. Pemulus takes one of the tablets and puts it in his palm and pokes at it with a calloused finger. What we're looking at, we're looking here at either a serious, sudden injection of cash. Axford makes a shocked noise. You'd actually try to peddle the incredibly potent DMZ around this sorry place? Pemulus's snort sounds like the letter K. Get a large economy-sized clue, Axe Handle. Nobody here'd have a clue what they'd even be dealing with, not to mention be willing to pay what they're worth. Why, there are pharmaceutical museums, left-wing think tanks, New York designer drug consortiums. I'm sure I'd be dying to dissect these. Decocked-like. Toss into the spectrometer and see what's what. That we could get bids from, you're saying? Axford says. Hal squeezes a bowl, silently looking at the hat. Pemulus turns the tablet over. Or certain very progressive and hip-type nursing homes I know guys that know of. Or down at Back Bay at that yogurt place with that picture of those historical guys Inc. was saying at breakfast was up on the wall. Ram Dass, William Burroughs. Or just down in Harvard Square at Abom Pan where all those 70s-era guys in old wool ponchos play chess against those little clocks they keep hitting. Axford's pretending to punch Hal's arm in excitement. Pemulus says, or of course, I'm thinking I could just go the sheer entertainment route and toss them in the Gatorade barrels at the meet with Port Washington Tuesday or down at the Whataburger. Watch everybody run around clutching their heads or whatever. I'd be way into watching Wayne play with distorted senses. Hal puts one foot up on Pemulus's little frustum-shaped bedside stool and leans farther in. Would it be prying to ask how you finally managed to get hold of these? It wouldn't be prying at all, Pemulus says, removing from the yachting caps lining every piece of contraband he's got, spreading it out on the bed, sort of the way older people will array all their valuables in quiet moments. He has a small quantity of personal consumption lamb's breath cannabis, bought back from Hal out of a 20-gram he'd sold Hal in a dusty baggie.
A little saran-wrapped cardboard rectangle with four black stars spaced evenly across it.
The odd dreen. And it looks like a baker's dozen of the incredibly potent DMZ. Sweet tart-sized tablets of no particular color, with a tiny mod hipster in each center, wishing the viewer peace. We don't even know how many hits this is, he muses quietly. There's sun on the wall, with a hanging viewer, and poster of the paranoid king, and an enormous hand-drawn Sierpinski gasket. In one of the three big mullioned west windows, the academy is nothing if not well-fenestrated, there's an oval flaw that's casting a bubble of ale-colored autumn sunlight from the window's left side to elongate onto Pemulus's tightly made bed.
73.
And he moves everything his hat's got into the brighter bubble, going down on one knee to study a tablet between his forceps. Pemulus owns stuff like philatelic forceps, a loop, a pharmaceutical scale, a postal scale, a personal size Bunsen burner, with the calm precision of a jeweler. The literature's mute on the titration. Do you take one tablet? He looks up on one side and then back around on the other at the boys' faces leaning in above. Is like half a tab a regulation hit? Two or even three tablets, maybe, Hal says, knowing he sounds greedy but unable to help himself. The accessible data's vague, Femula says, his profile contorted around the loop in his socket. The literature on mucimal lysergic blends is spotty and vague and hard to read except to say how massively powerful the supposed yields are. Hal looks at the top of Pemulus's head. Did you hit a medical library? Well, I got on med.com off lateral Alice's Watts line. It went back and forth and up and down through med.com.
Plenty on lysergics. Plenty on methoxy class hybrids.
Vague and almost gossip column-y shit on Fitvivi compounds. To get anything, you gotta cross-key ergotics with the phrase mucimal or mucimalated. Only a couple things ring the bell when you key in DMZ. Then they're all potent this, sinister that, nothing with any specifics.
And jumbly polysyllables out the ass. Whole thing gave me a migraine.
Yes, but did you actually hop in the truck and actually go to a real med library? Hal's his Mother Averill's child when it comes to databases, software, spell checks, etc. Axford now really does punch him once on the shoulder, albeit the right one. Pemulus is scratching absently at the little hair hurricane at the center of his hair. It's close to 14:30 hours, and the flawed bubble of light on the bed is getting to be a slightly sad color of early winter PM. There are still no sounds from the West Courts outside, but there's high song of much volume through the walls, water pipes. A lot of guys who are drilled past caring in the AM don't get it up to shower until after lunch.
Then sit through PM classes with wet hair and different clothes than their AM classes.
Pemulus rises to stand between them and looks around the empty three-bedded room again, with neat stacks of three players' clothes and bright gear on shelves and three wicker laundry hampers bulging slightly. There is the rich scent of athletic laundry, but other than that, the room looks almost professionally clean. Pemulus and Schacht's room makes Hal and Mario's room look like an insane asylum, Hal thinks. Axford drew one of the only two single upper-class rooms in last spring's lottery, the other having gone to the Vault twins, who get counted as one entry in room draw. Pemulus still has his cheeks screwed up to keep the loop in as he looks around. One monograph had this toss-off about DMZ where the guy invites you to envision acid that has itself dropped acid.
Holy crow!
One article at a fucking Moment, of all sources, talks about how this one army convict at Leavenworth got allegedly injected with some massive unspecified dose of early DMZ as part of some army experiment and Christ only knows what, and about how this convict's family sued over how the guy reportedly lost his mind. He directs the loop dramatically, at first Hal, and then Axford. I mean, literally lost his mind, like the massive dose picked his mind up and carried it off somewhere and put it down someplace and forgot where. I think we get the picture, Mike. Allegedly, Moment says how the guy's found later in his army cell in some impossible lotus position, singing show tunes in a scary, deadly accurate Ethel Merman impression voice. Axford says maybe Pemulus stumbled on a possible explanation for poor old Lyle and his lotus position down in the weight room, gesturing with a bad right hand in the direction of ComAd. Again, Pemulus, with a thing with a head. The slackening of a cheek lets the loop fall out and bounce off the drum-tight bed, and Pemulus gets it to rebound into his palm without even looking.
I think we can err on the side of not dickying the Gatorade barrels anyway. This soldier's story's moral was proceed with caution, big time. The guy's mind's still allegedly AWOL.
An old soldier now, still belting out Broadway melodies in some secretive institution someplace. Blood relatives try to sue on the guy's behalf. Army apparently came up with enough arguments to give the jury reasonable doubt about if the guy can even be said to legally exist enough to bring suit anymore, since the dose misplaced his mind. Axford feels absently at his elbow. So you're saying let's proceed with care, why don't we? Hal kneels to prod one of the tablets up against the dusty baggy side. His finger looks dark in the elongated bubble of light.
I'm thinking these look like two tablets are possibly a hit.
A kind of Motrin-ish look to them.
Visual guesswork isn't going to do it. This is not Bob Hope, Inc.
We could even designate it Ethel, for on the phone, Axford suggests. Pemulus watches Hal, arranging the tablets into the same general cardioid shape as ETA itself.
What I'm saying, this is not a fool's rush-in type substance, Inc. This show-tuned soldier, like, left the planet.
Well, so long as he waves every so often.
The sense I got is the only thing he waves at is his food.
But that was from a massive early dose, Axford says. Hal's arrangement of the tablets on the red and gray counterpane is almost zen in its precision.
These are from the 70s?
After intricate third-party negotiations, Michael Pemulis finally landed 650 milligrams of the vaunted and elusive compound DMZ, or Madame Psychosis, from a small-arms-draped duo of reputed former Canadian insurgents who now undertook small and probably kind of pathetic outdated insurgency projects from behind the front operation of a cut-rate mirror, blown glass, practical joke and gag, trendy postcard, and low-demand old film cartridge emporium called Antitoire Entertainment, just up Prospect Street from Inman Square in Cambridge's decayed Portugal-Brazilian district. Because Pemulis always conducts business solo and speaks no French, the whole transaction with the nook in charge had to be negotiated in dumb show. And since this lumberjackish Antitoire Nuckwad tended to look from side to side before he communicated, even more than Pemulis looked all around himself, with his dim-looking partner standing there cradling a broom and also scanning for eavesdroppers in the closed shop the whole time, the whole negotiated deal had resembled a kind of group psychomotor seizure, with different bits of whipping and waggling heads reflected in dislocated sections and at jagged angles in more mirrors and pebble-blown glass vases than Pemulis had ever seen crammed into anywhere. A very low-rent teepee, indeed, had a hardcore porn cartridge going at 5 times the normal speed, so it looked like crazed rodents and may have turned Pemulis's sexual glands off for all time, he feels. God alone knew where these clowns had acquired 13 incredibly potent 50-milligram artifacts of the BS 1970s. But the good news is, they were Canadians.
And like fucking nucksters about almost anything, they had no idea what they were in possession of was worth, as it slowly emerged.
Pemulis, with aid of 150 milligrams of time-release tenuate dosepan, almost danced a little post-transaction jig on his way up the steps of the Yoshio's Cambridge bus, feeling the way W. Penn in his Quaker Oats hat in like the 16th century must have felt, trading a few trinkets to Babe in the Woods natives for New Jersey, he imagines, doffing the nautical cap to two nuns in the aisle. Over the course of the next academic day, the incredibly potent stash now wrapped tight in saran and stashed deep in the toe of an old sneaker that sits atop the aluminum strut between two panels in sub-dorm B's drop ceiling, Pemulis's time-tested entrepot over the course of the next day or so, the matter's hashed out, and it's decided that while there's no real reason to involve Boone or Stice or Strzok or Trolch, it's really Pemulis and Axford and Hal's right, duty almost, to the spirits of inquiry and good trade practice, to sample the potentially incredibly potent DMZ in predeterminedly safe amounts before unleashing it on Boone or Trolch or any unwitting civilians. Axford, having been allowed in on the front end, the question of Hal's defraying the opportunity cost of his part in the experiment is tactfully broached and turns out to be no problem. Pemulis's markup isn't anything beyond accepted norms, and there's always room in Hal's budget for spirited inquiry. Hal's one condition is that somebody tech-literate actually take the truck down to BU or MIT's medical library and physically verify that the compound is both organic and non-addictive, which Pemulis says a physical hands-on library assault is already down in his day planner in pen anyway. After PM drills on Thursday, as Hal Incandenza and Pemulus, with camera-mounted Mario Incandenza in tow, stand with their hands in the chain-link mesh of one of the show court's fencing, and watch Teddy Schacht play a private exhibition against a Syrian satellite pro who's at ETA for 2 paid weeks of corrective instruction
on a service motion that's eroding his rotator cuff.
The guy wears thick glasses with a black athletic band around his head
and plays with an upright, square-jawed, liquid precision
and is dispatching Ted Schacht handily, which Schacht is taking with his customary sanguine good temper, giving his stolid all, learning what he can, one of very few genuinely stocky players at ETA, and one of the even fewer ranked junior players around without an apparent ego, wholly non-insecure since he blew out his knee on a contre-pied in the pre-Thanksgiving exhibition 3 years back, which is odd. Now, still in and at it just for the fun, and more or less doomed, therefore, to a purgatorial existence in 128 to 256 Alphabetville. As Pemulus and Hal stand there, sweaty in full red and gray ETA sweats on a raw 11:05 p.m., the sweat in their hair starting to accrete and freeze, Mario's head bowed under the weight of the head mount rig and his hideously arachnodactylic fingers whitening as the fence takes his forward weight, Hal's posture subtly but warmly inclined ever so slightly toward his tiny older brother, who resembles him the way creatures of the same order but not the same family might resemble one another. As they stand watching and hashing matters out, Hal and Pemulus, there's the thud and sprong of an EWD transnational catapult off way below to their left, and then the high keen sound of a waste displacement projectile the clowns are too low to let them see the flight of. Though a weirdly yellow, sheep-shaped cloud is visible somewhere up off past Acton, connecting the horizon seam to some kind of coming storm front, held off by the ATH-SCME fans, along the Lowell-Methuen stretch of border northwest. Pemulus finally nixes the notion of performing the spirited controlled experiment here in Enfield, where Axford has to be at the A-Squad's dawn drills every morning at 0500, and also Hal, unless he's slept over at the headmaster's house the night before, with the headmaster's house just not being a good DMZ dropping venue at all. Pemulus, scanning up and down the length of the fence and winking at Mario, posits that a solid 36 hours of demand-free time will be advisable for any interaction with the incredibly potent you-know-whatsky. That also lets out the inter-academy thing with Port Washington tomorrow, for which Charles Tavis has chartered 2 buses because so many ETA players are getting to go and do battle in this one. Port Washington Academy is gargantuan, the Xerox Inc. of North American tennis academies, with over 300 students and 64 courts, half of which they'll have already put under warm inflatable Testar cover as of like Halloween, PW staff being less into the value of elemental suffering than Stitt and company. So many that Tavis will almost surely go ahead and bus them all back up from Long Island just as soon as the post-competition dance is over, rather than shell out for all those motel rooms without corporate support. This ETA PW meet and buffet and dance our private inter-academy tradition, an epic rivalry almost a decade old. Plus, Pamela says he'll need a couple weeks of quality med library stacks tossing time to do the more exacting titration and side effects research Hal agrees the soldier's sobering story seems to dictate. So, they conclude, the window of opportunity looks to be 11:20 to 21, the weekend right after the big end-of-fiscal-year fundraising exhibition with the ETA, A and B squads, in singles against this year, Quebec's notoriously hapless Junior Davis and Junior Whiteman Cup squads.
74.
Invited down under very quiet, low-profile political conditions via the good expatriate offices of Averill and Condenza to get vivisected by Wayne and Hal and others, for the philanthropic amusement of ETA patrons and alums, then to dance the PM away at a catered supper and alumni ball, The weekend right before Thanksgiving week, and the Whataburger Invitational in sunny Arizona. Because this year, in addition to Friday, 11:20, they also get Saturday, 11:21 off. As in, from both class and practice. Because CT and Shtit have arranged a special one-match doubles exhibition for the Saturday AM following the big meet. One between two female coaches of the Quebecois Whitemans and ETA's infamous Vaught twins, Karen and Sharon Vaught, 17. ONAN's top-ranked junior women's doubles team, unbeaten in 3 years, an unbeatable duo, uncanny in their cooperation on the court, moving as one at all times, playing not just as if but in fact because they shared a brain, or at least the psychomotor lobes of one, the twins, Siamese, fused at the left and right temple, banned from singles by ONAN regs, the broad shadow-casting Vaughts, flinty-eyed, tire executives' daughters out of Akron, using her-slash-their four legs to cover chilling amounts of court, plus to sweep the Charleston competition at every post-exhibition formal ball for the last 5 years running.
Tavis will be on Wayne to play some sort of exhibitory thing, too,
though asking Wayne to publicly smear a second Quebecer in 2 days might be a bit much. And but everyone who's anyone will be down at the lung watching the Vaughts vivisect some adult-ranked nooks, plus maybe Wayne.
75.
Then the ETAs will get Saturday to rest and recharge before starting both the pre-Whataburger training week and the bell lap of prep for 12-12's boards, meaning late Friday night to Sunday AM will give Pemulis, Howe, and Axford, and maybe Struck if Pemulis needs to let Struck in for help with library tossing, enough time to psycho-spiritually rally from whatever meninges withering hangover the incredibly potent DMZ might involve. And Axford in the sauna predicted it would be a witherer indeed, since even just LSD alone, he observed, left you the next day not just sick or down but utterly empty, a shell, void inside, like your soul was a wrung-out sponge. Hal wasn't sure he concurred. An alcohol hangover was definitely no frolic in the psychic glade, all thirsty and sick and your eyes bulging and receding with your pulse. But after a night of involved hallucinogens, Hal said the dawn seemed to confer on his psyche a kind of pale, sweet aura, a luminescence.
76.
Halation, Axford observed. Pemulis appears to have left out of his calculations the fact that he'll get that Saturday PM off classes only if he makes the traveling list for the Tucson Whataburger the following week. And that unlike Hal and Axford, he's not a lock. Pemulis' USTA rank, accepting his Halcyon 13th year in the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken, has never gotten higher than 128. And the Whataburger draws kids from all over, ONAN, and even Europe. The draw will have to be weak indeed for him to get even one of the 64 qualifying round invitations. Axford's on the fringes of the top 50, but he got to go last year at 17, so he's almost got to get to go. And Hal is looking at getting a third or maybe fourth seed in 18's singles. He's definitely going, barring some sort of cataclysmic ankle relapse against either Port Washington or Quebec. Axford postulates that Pemulis isn't miscalculating so much as simply showing a slitty-eyed confidence, which as far as his match play outlook is concerned would be unusual, and rather a fine thing. Pro-rector Aubrey DeLint says, publicly, that seeing M. Pemulis in practice versus seeing M. Pemulis in a real match that means anything is like getting to know some girl through email as like email keyboard type pen pals and really falling for her, and then finally meeting her in person and finding out she's got like just one enormous tit in the exact middle of her chest or something like that.
77.
Mario will get to come along if Avril can convince CT to bring him along to get Whataburger footage for this year's ETA promotional Christmas giveaway to private and incorporated patrons cartridge. Shocked and the glossy Syrian are laughing together about something up at the net post.
where they've walked to gather gear and various spare rotator cuff and knee appliances,
after the Syrian kind of cornily jumped the net and pumped Schacht's hand, breath and sweat steam rising up off and moving off through the fences mesh toward the manicured western hills, as Mario's laugh rings out at some broad, mock supplicant's gesture Schacht's just now made. The 7th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. You can be at certain parties and not really be there. You can hear how certain parties have their own implied ends embedded in the choreography of the party itself. One of the saddest times Joelle Van Dyne ever feels anywhere is that invisible pivot where a party ends, even a bad party. That moment of unspoken accord when everyone starts collecting his lighter and date, jacket or greatcoat, his one last beer hanging from the plastic rind's five rings, says certain perfunctory things to the hostess in a way that acknowledges their perfunctoriness without seeming insincere, and leaves, usually shutting the door. When everybody's voices recede down the hall, when the hostess turns back in from the closed door and sees the litter and the expanding white V of utter silence in the party's wake. Joelle, at the end of her rope and preparing to hang from it, listening, is supported by a polished hardwood floor above both river and bay's edge, perched uncomfortably in striated light in one of Molly Notkin's chairs molded in the likeness of great filmmakers from the celluloid canon. Seated between empty Kuker and frightening Murnau, in Malaise's fiberglass lap, his trousers crease uncomfortable, and his cummerbund, MIT crested. The lurid chair's directors are larger than life. Joelle's feet dangle well off the floor, her squished hamstrings beginning to burn under a damp, thick cotton Brazilian skirt which is vivid, curled pale purples, and fresh red against a Latin black that seems to glow above pale knees and white rayon knee socks and feet in clogs that are hanging half off, legs swinging like a child's, always feeling like a child in Molly's chairs, conspicuously perched in the eye of a bad party's somewhat forced-feeling storm of wit and good cheer. Sitting by herself under what used to be her window, the daughter of a low-pH chemist and homemaker from Western Kentucky, a lot of fun to be with, normally, if you can get over the disconcerting veil. Among pernicious myths is the one where people always get very upbeat and generous and other-directed right before they eliminate their own map for keeps. The truth is that the hours before a suicide are usually an interval of enormous conceit and self-involvement. There are decorative bars, slender and of black iron, that pigeon droppings have made piebald, over the west windows to this third-floor cooperative apartment on the East Cambridge fringes of the Back Bay, where near Professor Notkin is holding a party to celebrate passing her orals in film and film cartridge theory, the doctoral program where Joelle, before her retreat into broadcast sound, had met her. Molly Notkin often confides on the phone to Joelle Van Dyne about the one tormented love of Notkin's life thus far, an erotically circumscribed G.W. Pabst scholar at New York University, tortured by the neurotic conviction that there are only a finite number of erections possible in the world at any one time, and that his tumescence means, for example, the detumescence of some perhaps more deserving or tortured third-world sorghum farmer or something, so that whenever he tumefies, he'll suffer the same order of guilt that your less eccentrically tortured PhD-type person will suffer at the idea of, say, wearing baby seal fur. Molly still takes the high-speed rail down to visit him every couple weeks, to be there for him in case, by some selfish mischance, he happens to harden, prompting in him black waves of self-disgust and an extreme neediness for understanding and non-judgmental love. She and poor Molly Notkin are just the same, Joelle reflects, seated alone, watching doctoral candidates taste wine. Sisters. Sororal twins. with her fear of direct light, Notkin. And the disguises and whiskers are simply veiled veils. How many Sub-Rosa twins are there out there, really? What if heredity, instead of linear, is branching? What if it's not arousal that's so finitely circumscribed? What if, in fact, there were ever only like two really distinct individual people walking around back there in history's mist? That all difference descends from this difference. The whole and the partial, the damaged and the intact, the deformed and the paralyzingly beautiful, the insane and the attendant, the hidden and the blindingly open, the performer and the audience, no Zen type one, always rather two, one upside down in a convex lens. Joelle is thinking about what she has in her purse. She sits alone in her linen veil and pretty skirt, obliquely looked at, listening to bits of conversation. She reels in out of the overall voice's noise, but seeing no one really else. The absolute end of her life and beauty running in a kind of stuttered, old, handheld 16mm before her eyes, projected against the white screen on her side for once from Uncle Bud, and twirling to Orin and Jim and YYY, all the way up to today's wet walk here from the Red Line's downtown stop, walking the whole way from East Charles Street, employing a self-conscious and kind of formal stride, but undeniably pretty. The overall walk at her last hours was, on this last day before the great O-N-A-N-ite Interdependence Revel. East Charles to the Back Bay today is a route full of rained-on, sienna-glazed streets and upscale businesses with awnings and wooden signs hung with cute colonial script, and people looking at her like you look at the blind, naked gazes, not knowing she could see everything at all times. She likes the wet walk for this, everything milky and halated through her veil's damp linen, the brick sidewalks of Charles Street unchipped and impersonally crowded, her legs on autopilot, she a perceptual engine, holding the collar of her overcoat closed at her poncho's neckline in a way that lets her hold the veil secure against her face with a finger on her chin, thinking always about what she has in her purse, stopping in at a discount tobacconist and buying a quality cigar in a glass tube, and then a block later placing the cigar inside carefully in among the overflowing waste atop a corner receptacle of pine-green mesh, but keeps the tube, puts the glass tube in her purse, can hear the rains thup on tight umbrellas, and hear it hiss in the street, and can see droplets broken and regathering on her polyresin coat. Cars sheening by with the special lonely sound of cars in rain. Wipers making black rainbows on taxis' shining windshields. In every alley are green IWD dumpsters and the smaller red IWD dumpsters to take the overflow from the green dumpsters. And the sound of her wood-sole clogs against the receding staccato of brittle women's high heels on brick westward as Charles Street now approaches Boston Common and becomes less quaint and upscale. Sodden litter, flat, the way only wet litter can be flat, appears on the sidewalk and in the curb's seam. And now murky-colored people with sacks and grocery carts appraising that litter, squatting to lift and sift through litter, and the rustle and jut of limbs from dumpsters being sifted by people who all day do nothing but sift through IWD dumpsters, and other people's blue, shoeless limbs extending in coronal rays from refrigerator boxes in each block's three alleys, and the little cataract of rainwater off the edge of each dumpster's red annex's downsloping side and hitting refrigerator boxes' tops with a rhythmless thappa-thappa-pa-thap. Somebody going psst from an alley's lip, and ghastly white or blotched faces declaiming to thin air from recessed doorways curtained by rain. And for an other-directed second, Joelle wishes she'd hung on to the cigar to give away, and moving westward into the territory of the endless stem near the end of Charles, she starts to dispense change she has asked for from doorways and inverted up-tilted boxes, and she gets asked about the deal with the veil with a lack of delicacy she rather prefers. A sooty wheelchaired man with a dead white face below a Notre Ray Pays cap silently extends a hand for coins. A puffed red cut across the businesslike palm is half-healed and almost visibly closing. It looks like a dent in dough. Joel gives him a folded US 20 and likes that he says nothing. She buys a 0.473-liter Pepsi Cola in a blunt plastic bottle at a Store 24, whose Jordanian clerk just looks at her blankly when she asks if they carry big red soda water, and settles for the Pepsi, and comes out and pours the pop out down a storm drain, and watches it pool there, foaming, brownly, and stay put because the drain's grate is clogged solid with leaves and sodden litter. She walks on toward the common with the empty bottle and glass tube in her purse. There is no need to buy chore boy pads at the Store 24. Joelle Van Dyne is excruciatingly alive and encaged, and in the director's lap can call up everything from all times. What will be that most self-involved of acts, self-canceling? To lock oneself in Molly Notkin's bedroom or bath and get so high that she's going to fall down and stop breathing and turn blue and die, clutching her heart. No more back and forth. Boston Common is like a lush hole Boston's built itself around. A 2 kilometer square of shiny trees and dripping limbs and green benches over wet grass. Pigeons all over, the same sooty cream as the willow's rinds. 3 young black men perched like tough crows along a bench's back approve her body and call her bitch with harmless affection and ask where's the wedding at. No more deciding to stop at 2300 hours, and then barely getting through the hour's show, and hurtling back home at 0130 hours and smoking the chore boy's resins and not stopping after all. No more throwing the material away, and then half an hour later rooting through the trash. No more all-fours scrutiny of the carpet in hopes of a piece of lint that looks enough like the material to try to smoke. No more singeing the selvage of veils. The common south edge is Boylston Street, with its 24/7 commerce, upscale cashmere scarves and cellular holsters, doormen with gold braid, jewelers with 3 names, women with valence curtain bangs, stores disgorging shoppers with their wide, white, monogrammed, twine-handled bags. The rain's wet veil blurs things like Jim had designed in his neonatal lens to blur things in imitation of a neonatal retina, everything recognizable and yet without outline. A blur that's more deforming than fuzzy, no more clutching her heart on a nightly basis. What looks like the cage's exit is actually the bars of the cage. The afternoon's meshes. The entrance says exit. There isn't an exit. The ultimate annular fusion, that of exhibit and its cage. Jim's own cage number 3, Free Show. It is the cage that has entered her, somehow. The ingenuity of the whole thing is beyond her. The fun has long since dropped off the too much. She's lost the ability to lie to herself about being able to quit, or even about enjoying it still. It no longer delimits and fills the hole. It no longer delimits the hole. There's a certain smell to a rain-wet veil, something about that caller and the moon saying the moon never looked away, revolving and yet not. She had hurtled on back home on the night's final tea and gone home and at least finally not turned her face away from the situation. The predicament that she didn't love it anymore. She hated it and wanted to stop, and also couldn't stop or imagine stopping or living without it. She had in a way done as they'd made Jim do near the end and admitted powerlessness over this cage, this unfree show, weeping, literally clutching her heart, smoking first the chore boy scrap she'd used to trap the vapors and form a smokable resin, then bits of the carpet and the acetate panties she'd filtered the solution through hours earlier, weeping and veilless and yarn-haired like some grotesque clown in all 4 mirrors of her little room's walls. Chronology of Organization of North American Nations Revenue-Enhancing Subsidized Time by Year. 1. Year of the Whopper. 2. Year of the Tuck's Medicated Pad. 3. Year of the Trial Size Dove Bar. 4. Year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken. 5. Year of the Whisper Quiet Maytag Dishmaster. 6. Year of the You Shit You 2007 Mimetic Resolution Cartridge View Motherboard Easy to Install Upgrade for Infernitron Interlace TP Systems for Home, Office, or Mobile. 7. Year of Dairy Products from the American Heartland. 8. Year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. 9. Year of GLAD.
78.
Jim's eldest, Orin,
punter extraordinaire, dodger of flung acid extraordinaire, had once shown Joel Van Dyne his childhood collection of husks of the lemon pledge that the school's players used to keep the sun off. Different sized legs and portions of legs, well-muscled arms, a battery of five-holed masks hung on nails from an upright fiberboard sheet. Not all the husks had names below them. Boylston Street East means she passes again the black bronze equestrian statue of Boston's Colonel Shaw and the Massachusetts 54th, illuminated now by a patch of emergent sunlight. Shaw's metal head and raised sword, illicitly draped in a large Quebecois fleur-de-lis flag with all four irises, stems, altered to red blades. So it's absurdly now a red, white, and blue flag. Three Boston cops on ladders with poles and shears. The Canadian militants come in the night, on the eve of interdependence, thinking anyone cares whether they hang things from historic icons, hang anti-ONAN flags, as if anyone not paid to remove them cares one way or the other. The encaged and suicidal have a really hard time imagining anyone caring passionately about anything. And here, too, are East Boylston's dealers, sirens of the other second cage, standing, as always, outside F.A.O. Schwartz, young little black boys, boys so black they're blue, horrifically skinny and young, little more than living shadows in knit caps and knee-length sweatshirts and very white high tops, shifting and blowing into their cupped hands, alluding to the availability of a certain material. Just barely eluding is all, with their postures and bored, blank, important gaze. Certain salesmen have only to stand there. Certain types of sales, the customer comes to you, and lo. The cops at the flag across the street don't give them a look. Joelle hurries past the line of dealers. She tries to, her clogs loose and clocking, tarrying for just a moment at the end, just past the gauntlet's end, still within two extended hands' reach of the last bored dealer. For here on the street outside Schwartz is placed an odd adverting display. Not a live salesman of any sort, but rather a humanoid figure of something that's better than cardboard, untouched by the vendors, who don't seem even to look. A display on an angled rear mount stand, like a photo frame stand. 2D, the figure of a man in a wheelchair, in a coat and tie, his lap blanketed and no legs below. His well-fed face, artistically reddened with some terrible joy. His smile's arc of the extreme curvature that exists between mirth and fury. His ecstasy terrible to see. His head hairless and plastic and cast back. His eyes on the blue harlequin patches of the post-storm sky, looking straight up, or having a seizure, or ecstatic. His arms also up and out in a gesture of submission or triumph or thanks. His oddly thick right hand, the receptacle for the black spine of the case of some new film cartridge being advertised for distribution. The cartridge stuck like a tongue out of a slot in his lineless palm. Except There is only this display, this ecstatic figure, and a cartridge no feral vendors removed. No mention of title, no blurbs, or quoted references to critics' thumbs. The case's spine itself, bare black, slightly pebble generic plastic, conspicuously unlabeled. Two Oriental women's shopping bags catch and make her raincoat billow slightly as Joelle stands there, briefly, feeling the lines dealers looking at her, assessing. And then someone calls something to one of the cops halfway up the statue, using his first name, which echoes slightly and breaks the spell. The little black boys look away. None of the passers-by seem to notice the display she stands before, reflecting. It's some kind of anti-ad, to direct attention at what is not said. Lead up to an inevitability you deny. Not new, but an expensive and affecting display. The film cartridge itself would be a blank too, or the case empty. Worthless because it really can be removed all the way from the slot in the figure's hand. Joelle removes it and looks at it and puts it back. She's had her last fling with film cartridges. Jim had used her several times. Jim, at the end, had filmed her at prodigious and multi-lensed length and refused to share what he'd made of it and died without a note.
79.
Her mental name for the man had been Infinite Jim. The display cartridge shoves home with a click. One of the such young dealers calls her mama and asks, "Where's the funeral at?" For a while, after the acid, after first Oren left and then Jim came and made her sit through that filmed apology scene, and then vanished and then came back, but only 4 years, 7 months, 6 days passed to leave for a while after taking the veil. For a while, she liked to get really high and clean, Joelle did. Scrub sinks until they were mint white. Dust the ceilings without using any kind of ladder. Vacuum like a fiend and put in a fresh vacuum bag after each room. Imitate the wife and mother they both declined to shoot. Use Incandenza's toothbrush on tile's grout. In places along Boylston, cars are triple parked. People's wipers are on that setting that Joelle, who does not drive, imagines to read occasional on the controls. Her own personal daddy's old car had wipers controls on the turn signal stalk by the wheel. Available yellow cabs pass, hissing in the streets. Over half the passing cabs out here in the rain are advertising themselves as available. Purple numbers lit below taxi. As she remembers things Jim was. Besides a great filmic mind and her true heart's friend, the world's best hailer of Boston cabs, known to have less hailed than conjured cabs in spots where Boston cabs, by all that's right, just aren't. A hailer of Boston cabs in places like Vetersburg, Indiana, and Powell, Wyoming. Something in the authority of the lifted arm's height. The oncoming taxi undergoing a sort of parallax as it bore down over tumbleweed streets, appearing under Incandenza's upraised palm, as if awaiting benediction. He was a tall and physically slow-moving man with a great love of taxis, and they loved him back. Never again a cab in 4+ years after that. And so Joelle Van Dyne, a.k.a. Madam P., surrendered, suicidal, eschews tumbrel or hack, her solid clog sounding formal on the smooth cement down Boylston's sidewalk past fine stores revolving doors, southeast toward serious brownstone terrain, open coat swirling over poncho, and hanging rain breaking into stutters and drips. After she had smoked homemade freebase cocaine this AM for the last time, and then fired up the chore boys and good panties she'd used as a last filter, and choked on burnt acetate when she shredded and smoked them, and had wept and imprecated at the mirrors and thrown away her paraphernalia again for the final time, when an hour later she'd walked not formally to her tea stop under a parliament of gathering storm clouds and faint sticky bits of autumn thunder to ride to Upper Brighton and find Lady Delfina, get real weight from Lady Delphina. So hard to just cut it off in mid-binge, on a Saturday, unless you just passed out.